got so many books here, I'm hoping I keep record of my place. Right, so I'm just going to start off. We're continuing the series that we started last week about facing your giants. And tonight's one is called Silent Phones. And the passage is 1 Samuel 16. And it's Samuel anoints David as king. Now the Lord said to Samuel, "You have mourned long enough for Saul. I have rejected him as king of Israel. So fill your flask with olive oil and go to Bethlehem. Find a man named Jesse who lives there, for I have selected one of his sons to be my king." But Samuel asked, "How can I do that? If Saul hears about it, he will kill me." "Take a heifer with you," the Lord replied, "and say that you have come to make a sacrifice to the Lord. Invite Jesse to the sacrifice, and I will show you which of his sons to anoint for me." So Samuel did as the Lord instructed. When he arrived at Bethlehem, the elders of the town came trembling to meet him. "What's wrong?" they asked. "Do you come in peace?" "Yes," Samuel replied. "I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. Purify yourselves and come with me to the sacrifice." Then Samuel performed the purification rite for Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice too. When they arrived, Samuel took one look at Eliab and thought, "Surely this is the Lord's anointed." But the Lord said to Samuel, "Don't judge by his appearance or height, for I have rejected him. The Lord doesn't see things the way you see them. People judge by outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart." Then Jesse told his son Abinadab to step forward and walk in front of Samuel. But Samuel said, "This is not the one the Lord has chosen." Next, Jesse summoned Shimeah. Then Samuel said, "Neither is this the one the Lord has chosen." In the same way, all seven of Jesse's sons were presented to Samuel. But Samuel said to Jesse, "The Lord has not chosen any of these." When Samuel asked, "Are these all the sons you have?" "There is still the youngest," Jesse replied, "but he's out in the fields watching the sheep and the goats." "Send for him at once," Samuel said. "He will not sit down to eat until he arrives." So Jesse sent for him. He was dark and handsome with beautiful eyes. And the Lord said, "This is the one, anoint him." So as David stood there among his brothers, Samuel took the flask of olive oil he had brought and anointed David with the oil. And the Spirit of the Lord came powerfully upon David from that day on. Then Samuel returned to Ramah. I think, like David last week, I chose a passage that has some great names in that to try and pronounce. The thing about tonight, I was reading the Max Lucado book, and I couldn't relate to the story that he was talking about in the chapter. Where he had been waiting on this phone call from the sports team that he'd wanted to be a part of, and it never came. I think I only tried playing hockey, and I just got bored of it. So it wasn't that I was that sort of like sad that I didn't get on the team. I didn't like it. But as I was thinking about it, I was trying to think of sort of things, you know, like it got me starting to think about things from when I was a kid. You know, like this feeling of not being included. When I was a kid, I got picked on something severe. I was never part of the crowd. I think pretty much it probably in my mind, this is a little bit of an exaggeration, but I think everybody in the primary school was pretty much against me, including the teachers. I know it sounds severe, but, you know, like, some of the teachers were quite mean to me as well, because I think when I was about 9, my mum and dad started going. I went to a Catholic primary school, and I'd started doing, you know, my First Holy Communion and all of these kind of things. And when I was 9, my mum and dad started going to one of the Christian churches over in Alloa. And so my sister and I, we'd started going as well. So basically, my sort of path to being a confirmed Catholic stopped. I think the last thing I'd done was my first Holy Communion, and there was confirmation after that. I think Susan's nodding, great. So the first Holy Confirmation is after that, and I didn't do that. And because I'd been sort of like set aside from everything and wasn't included, people started to ask questions. And being quite enthusiastic about being a new Christian, even though I was quite young, when we'd play games in the schoolyard, I would sort of say stuff like, you know, I'm a knight, I've got the sword of the spirit, and, you know, and sort of like started to rhyme off all this kind of stuff and really didn't do myself any favours. But I got like beat up and picked on, and so I started to kind of take myself away from that. And I always enjoyed worship, so my dad would play plays guitar for us at night, and we practice all the songs and stuff like that. So I would take the music in and just sit to the side in at playtime and just read the music and learn the songs. And I would even get people like seeking me out to come up and, you know, pick on me, and they would take the music off me and they try to break my fingers, and, you know, sort of like it was really hard going. I've never felt, as I say, it's probably in my mind, you know, from the it was devastating as a child, but, you know, it was really hard going. And as I say, the teachers picked on me. We'd been helping at one of the local churches, I think just doing a tidy-up session, and they had a mass afterwards where all the kids from my year were to come up, and as a thank you, girls got pink rosary beads and boys got blue rosary beads. And I, you know, nobody said that I couldn't go up, so I went up and got my rosary beads, and I loved them, and I've still got them, but my teacher pulled me to the side and told me, how dare you go up and get one of them? They're not for you. You shouldn't have went up. And really gave me a row, and I've never felt so out of place, so much so that when we were to go to high school, rather than going with everybody, like the people that were my friends, rather going with my friends to the Catholic high school in Falkirk, my mum and dad made a special appointment to go to the local high school, which was just actually next door to my primary school, and we went to that instead because it took us away completely from the bullying and the judgment that was sort of being put on us there. So my experience of exclusion as a child is quite, you know, it's quite sort of severe, and it's something that stuck with me for a while, for ages, you know. But coming away from it, and sort of there was a freedom from that, because, you know, I went to a high school where I knew nobody, I had no friends, so I was quite easy to choose whatever I wanted to do. I was able to grow my I want to say my freak, but that's maybe not the. I was able to express myself freely, sort of cutting around with my tartan trousers and my Doc Martens and all that sort of stuff, before I was able to get my pink hair and things. So I wasn't scared to start developing who I am now, because I had no friends really at that point or no friends that sort of lasted in any way. I would sort of have different friends, but so I look at it as a positive, that, you know, I had that opportunity to move on and to sort of grow as somebody not hampered by these things that happened behind me. So as I say, that seems like something that's really, you know, it's quite a big thing, but it happened, you know, when I, like, sort of, you go to high school when you're 12. So by the time I was 12, that was all over and done with. And it's something that, you know, it's still, yeah, if I think about it now, like too much, it does hurt a little bit. But that exclusion no longer bothers me, because I can see now sort of the benefit that it had on me, allowing me to kind of find out who I am now and who I was and what I wanted to study. And I didn't care that, you know, everybody else was picking chemistry or biology or whatever. I wanted to do art and music, and I just went off and done that. But as I think about sort of the silent phone idea as an adult, there was nothing that was coming to mind sort of right away, because, you know, for so many years now, I've had my own business. So really, if anything I'm wanting done, you know, I'm kind of going on and doing it, and sort of not getting a client coming back to you and saying that you've got a contract is kind of just the run-of-the-mill thing. But the thing that really got me thinking, sort of the middle of the week there, was last year. A few of you will know that I'd been asked to go and teach at Heriot Watt, and I was so excited, because I'd went with Claire Dow to a fashion show, the graduate fashion show, and we got back in touch with some of the lecturers that I'd had when I went to university there, and one of the guys who was the president of the student union was the head of the course that I studied on. And then a couple of months later, I got a phone call from Bruce, and he was just like, oh, hey, you know, we're a bit short-staffed, we need somebody to stand in. And I was just like, this is exciting, you know, one day a week I'll get to go down there and teach and do some exciting stuff. And I'd done that, and it was good fun. The thing was, though, is I'd done one semester, and it was really hard going. I was exhausted because it was an hour to drive down to Gala, and then two hours to drive from Gala to Falkirk to go to work to sort of finish off orders in the shop. So it was shattering. When they asked me to do the next semester, I was like, okay, I could do with the money, and the experience would be good, and all that kind of thing. And so I'd done the second semester there, and the thing that I got from that, it was really hard because I didn't have much of a mentor. Bruce was really busy sort of learning his role as sort of this new head of the course. So his time really wasn't able to be spent sort of helping me find out what I was doing. So I was kind of just dropped in it and really felt like, you know, somebody just kicked me into the deep end of the pool and I was this close to drowning. But the thing with that was it was still really good fun. It was still really nice to go back. It'd been almost 10 years since I'd been at the university from being a student there, and it was nice going back. The last time I was there, I was a technician covering maternity leave to then being a sort of approved teacher lecturer. But what had happened was at the end of the semester, we'd done all the marking and everything got submitted, and I came home and I'd spoken to Eck, and I was like, I'm just exhausted. I don't think I could do that again. And I just kind of got on with it. And then at the end of the summer there, I sort of started to think, oh, they'll be starting back. I know that they've not sort of replaced any staff or got anything else. And I was like, I wonder why they never called. And I started to really think about, sort of dwell on the fact that Bruce had never called me back, had never invited me back. Because it had kind of been spoken about, maybe, you know, if it was, nothing had ever been set down in stone. And I'd already had this conversation with Ex saying it just about killed me trying to run my business and do all the stuff that I do at the church and, you know, and then sort of like do this massive traveling. I think there was one night I came to a meeting at the Kirk Hall and pretty much just broke down in tears because I'd just been exhausted and I was worried about sort of being able to spend time with Ex and, you know, all this kind of stuff. So it was just, my mind was melting with it. So I hadn't even wanted to, but it started to really get me worried about, you know, have they not phoned me? Have they not been back in touch because I wasn't good at it? Was I really that bad? You know, could I not teach? Could I not relate to the students? Could I not, you know, get on well with the colleagues that were there? You know, and started to sort of mull this over in my head about why, for what reason they wouldn't have called, despite the fact that, you know, maybe Bruce has managed to now cover everything and everything sorted out with their timetable, that they just didn't need me. You know, I'd served my purpose for that time. I wasn't thinking about that. But this phone call now that I've thought about it, why haven't they phoned? It's never bothered me before, but why didn't they phone? You know, and started to doubt who I was, the skills that I have, because, you know, I think I can teach. I'm standing up here. I hope I can teach or sort of relate to people and do that kind of thing. But I really doubted sort of everything that I was because of that missed phone call or that no phone phone call from Bruce about, you know, coming back and teach him. And just that thing really started to sort of sit in my head as to why, you know, why that's not happened. Why hasn't that call come through? And to be honest, you know, I wouldn't want the call. That's the thing that gets me the most. I don't want that call. I've got other stuff that I want to be doing now with my life. I don't want to be back down there running around. I was happy to do that year, but it's still now that I've thought about it, so this book's got a lot to answer for, because now at the back of my head, it's nipping away at me, just being like, why didn't he call? Why didn't he call? But I know why he didn't call. I know that there's other things that I'm meant to be doing. So that summer, so at the end of the summer there, it did start to sort of niggle at me, and then I started to think about it again as to why, you know, why this phone call never happened. But as I said, the thing here that I need to remember is that phone call never happened is because it's not what I want, it's not what God wants, and I know that. I can't sit and spend my time worrying about a phone call that never happened, because there's so much that God is wanting me to do and wanting to do with me that I should be focusing on instead. And the problem with this Goliath of exclusion is that it distracts you from what God's wanting you to do. And it starts to draw our focus away from what God wants us to focus on. And as we read the passage in 1 Samuel 16, Samuel starts to go to Jesse's house and he looks at all the brothers that are there. And he looks at the oldest brother and he thinks, oh, he's the eldest. He's the one, definitely. Big, strong, handsome chap. He's definitely the one. And his focus gets diverted for a minute because he's looking at something else that's not what God's saying. He's just looking at what's there. And it's not what God wants. He's not listening to what God has sent him there to do. And he seems, when you read it, it's almost like he seems a bit surprised when God's like, no, he's not the one. He's not the one I want. I think the way that Max Lucado writes it in the book, it's quite a nice narrative that he's got. Very American. Sorry, if there... No, we're lacking Americans today. That's fine. It's really American, but it's the way that he says it. The scene has a dog show feel to it. Samuel examines the boys one at a time like canines on leashes, more than once ready to give the blue ribbon, but each time God stops him. Eliab, the oldest, seems the logical choice. Envision him as the village Casanova, wavy hair, strong jawed. He wears tight jeans and has a piano keyboard smile. This is the guy, Samuel thinks. Wrong, says God. Abinadab enters as brother and contestant number two. You'd think a GQ model had walked in an Italian suit, alligator skin shoes. Bob, jet black, oiled back hair. What a classy king. Oh, want a classy king? Abinadab has the bling bling. God's not into classy. Samuel asks for brother number three, Shammah. He's bookish, studious. Could use a charisma transplant, but busting with brains, has a degree from State University and his eyes on the postgraduate program in Egypt. Jesse whispers to Samuel, valedictorian of Bethlehem High. Samuel is impressed, but God isn't. He reminds the priest, God doesn't see the same way people see. People look at the outside of a person, but the Lord looks at the heart. And that last bit for what God's saying to Samuel is directly quoted from Samuel 16, verse 7. And I think that's the thing, you know, we can get, our sight can be distracted by maybe the pretty things, the things that people expect of us, the things that we're going to, we think is sort of maybe the better way to do it. For me, the university post was sort of like a bit of a buzz because I was a student there. I was then a technician, and now I'm going back as an approved teacher. You know, so it comes across as this kind of heightened sort of status. And, you know, and being self-employed, having a regular income is actually a really nice thing to know, especially around about Christmas. But then sort of having just had Christmas there and not having the job at the university, we were really blessed by being so busy. And I truly believe, again, that although that I sit and ponder this phone call that's never happened, I've had the busiest Christmas that I've ever had in my business. So, you know, like if I'd been doing that thing at Heriot Watt, I might have missed out on some of those orders, or I might not have done half of the stuff that I'd done there. So I know in my heart that it's, you know, like the focus that I have on maybe the sort of the name or the title that I can get from being this college lecturer at Heriot Watt isn't for me. You know, it's not, I don't want to be teaching, you know, how to properly put a cover stitch on sportswear, or, you know, that to get the right elasticity in the seam. You know, I don't want to be teaching that. I forgot it when I graduated, let alone go back to learn it again, to teach it on again. You know, I've moved on. I've got other things. I was at a training day at Central to finish off sort of like our huddle kind of training stuff. And we were in... they'd separated us into huddles, and I'd been sitting thinking about sort of all sorts of kind of bits and bobs to do with, you know, my business and ministry and all that kind of stuff. And somebody turned around and said to me, oh, you're self-employed. You need to remember that your ministry is, you know, your business. God's gave you that. And I was just like, oh, yeah. You know, it was like the penny dropping. It's that other thing that, you know, I have something that God's already gave me to do. This, I think that just that time at Heriot Watt was just maybe a nice gap for me to refocus on what I wanted, because I'd been looking for other things. I'd been not sure if my business was the thing for me. And I think it's brought a lot of focus by doing something else for a period. And it's allowed me to really sit down and start to listen to God again about what happens next. So I think the thing that we need to remember is not to get distracted by what society thinks that we should be looking for in the people that God's calling, as in you and I. Don't get distracted by it. Don't start thinking that just because it maybe gives you enough money, or you know, you're going to get sort of like a title with it, that that's the thing that God's wanting you to do. It's not the outward appearance that counts. It's what's in your heart. Acts 13, verse 22 said, "But God removed Saul and replaced him with David, a man about whom God said, 'I have found David, son of Jesse, a man after my own heart. He will do everything I want him to do.'" The thing that really sort of, when I've been thinking about all of this week, is what is it to seek God's heart? What does it mean to seek God's heart, to be seeking God's heart? And I think that answers all of my questions that I've had about, you know, these missed calls or that sort of exclusion. It's looking for what God wants. It's listening to God. The Greek word, I'm not going to pronounce it, the Greek word for fellowship actually means partnership and communion. Seeking God's heart means partnership and communion. It's becoming one with God. And that, when God is looking for the next king of Israel, he's looking for someone that's a man after his own heart, or a woman after his own heart. Someone that will listen to God and do everything he wants him to do. Seeking God's heart, I kind of felt that it was something that we kind of bat around a lot. You know, it's one of those phrases that you hear a lot of people saying. And I really, you know, I had to sit and think about it for a while, because I was like, oh yeah, seeking God's heart. And I didn't know what it was. You know, as I say, I became a Christian when I was 9. And I had to stop and think what it was to seek God's heart, what that meant. And the fact that it's an intimate and full relationship with God, that's a partnership and a communion. All I could think of was this image of sort of like my marriage, you know, that wholehearted thing that I've put into with Ek, you know, where we go through everything, we chat through everything together. No decision is made unless we both agree on it, or the other one can sort of, you know, make the other one sort of change their mind. But it's that sort of, you know, it's that giving your all to that one person for the rest of your life. It was the only thing that I could think of that made me understand what that partnership and communion and intimate and full relationship meant. To be seeking God's heart is to just give it your all. I think for so much of my life, I've kind of just sort of sat on a fence and maybe danced back and forward with it and been like, yeah, you know, it is for me. Yeah, it is for me. And I've never turned around and been someone to say it's not for me, but it's that thing that I've been a bit kind of hesitant to sort of sometimes fling myself in fully, because it's quite scary. It's a really scary thing to do. But the thing that I laughed at when reading this chapter was just, and it's what something that David was talking about last week, was just the imperfection of David in the Bible. not David Hill, but just this imperfection of David. You know, he sort of lusted after, you know, another man's wife, and then had that guy killed, and you know, done some other not so great stuff. And I sit there and I'm just thinking, a man after my own heart. God said, a man after my own heart. I have found a man after my own heart in David. This guy who was not perfect, who was the youngest son, who was out in a field watching the sheep, who was basically the runt of the litter that Jesse didn't even want to invite into the house at the time because he didn't even want to introduce him. So he wasn't that highly thought of. He wasn't that important to his dad. You know, it was just kick him out and go and look after the sheep in the field. So when you start to feel, you know, it's really easy, as I say, the stuff that happened for me in primary school or this phone call that never happened from the university, it's really easy to get focused on feeling less than less than less. You know, something on the bottom of my shoe that I've just walked through mud, you know, that less, that when you see it on your shiny white trainers, you're just like, ugh. You know, that lowest of low. You can feel like that if you start to focus on these things. But the thing to remember is that God has said, I have found a man after my own heart, when he saw David. That to me, you know, like I love the fact that whenever I do anything, when I'm speaking, I always get this, I feel like hindsight is such a blessing, because you can look back at these nutters in the Bible and just be like, wow, they screwed up so much worse than me. And then feel good about yourself, because, you know, I do feel so bad about myself sometimes. I can be my worst critic. I can be really severe and hard on myself. And sometimes I think I maybe go over the top on it, but, you know, when I look at the Bible, I can really feel good about myself. You know, you really can, because some of the guys that are doing amazing things, you know, have, like, killed people and done all that sort of rotten stuff. And, you know, like, I have never killed anybody, so I'm beating half of these guys already. I feel good about myself. You know, so that's the thing. This giant, this Goliath of exclusion can really, as David was talking last week about Goliath himself, everybody was focused in on who Goliath was. You know, like, everybody that was talking in that passage was talking about Goliath, but when David got there, he hardly mentioned Goliath. He was focused on God, and I think that's the thing that we need to remember, is this Goliath of exclusion is something that we can all really easily relate to, that somebody's pushed us aside or forgot about us or, you know, not bothered about us or called us something insignificant, and we can really easily focus on that and get caught up in it, but it's not the case. It's not something that we need to focus on. I've skipped over some of my notes, but I want to read this bit for you. Sometimes we can sit and wonder, you know, how's the best way to start seeking God's heart? And the only thing that I can say is somebody that struggles to maybe get that quiet time going with God, to do sort of like, to get into the regime of, you know, a quiet time and Bible study and prayer. And although I try and do it, you know, all the time, it's hard to get into. I find it hard to keep that consistent sort of pattern of a daily sort of relationship with God. And I struggle with that. But the thing that I find that's really easy, and I was so glad it was one of the things that they said in the book, as to how to get yourself into the habit of seeking God's heart. One of the best ways to become a person after God's own heart is to spend time around men and women after God's own heart. Identify two or three mature believers who you believe have a close walk with Christ and interview them. Find out what makes them tick, how they nurture their relationship with God, and what they do when they grow discouraged. I can honestly say that in the last 3 years, My walk with God has only improved because I've had an amazing group of people around me to encourage me. That I've been spending time with people who are actively seeking God, and it's made me want to actively seek God as well. Because when I find it hard, I've been able to go and see these guys with my huddle and my house group and various other sort of people that have been alongside me. But I've had these people around me who are actively seeking God, who are actively after knowing the heart of God. And if you find it hard to do this study or to feel good about yourself or to think that God holds you as precious, then get more people around you that are actively seeking God, that are actively wanting to know God's heart, that put him at the forefront. Because it's one of those things that, you know, for when we moved to Edinburgh for a while, the only friends that I really had were non-Christians. And for a time, towards the sort of the 5-year mark that we'd been in the city, like I could really feel this kind of emptiness and gap and sort of this missing sort of something. You know, that image that they use at the Alpha course with the guy missing the bit in the middle. You know, like I could feel that. And when I started doing my huddles and the house group, and I've always had house groups, but it really has been something in the last 3 years that when I think about it, has blew me away, being around people that are so passionate about God, and how that affects me. How now, as somebody, like I never used to listen to that much worship music. But now I always catch myself singing praise music or thinking of something that somebody said at like house group or at huddle. The fact that I'm being challenged and held accountable for stuff that I'm saying that I feel that God's speaking to me. You know, so if you do find it hard to get round this giant of exclusion, that you just feel that you're always being put down, get yourself around a really good group of Christian people that you can start opening yourself up to. You know, get involved in a house group, go to the Alpha course, that kind of thing. Get involved in that sort of stuff and start to really seek God's heart by seeing how other Christians are doing it. Just to sort of finish it up, I'm going to skip through a couple of things and go to this one. The eyes of the Lord search the whole earth in order to strengthen those whose hearts are fully committed to him. This is a big world we live in, and you can feel small. But God searches the whole earth in order to strengthen those whose hearts are fully committed to him. Doesn't matter how small you feel in this massive planet, God will find you and strengthen you. Lift your eyes, giant slayer. The God who made a miracle out of David stands ready to make a miracle out of you. God wants to make a miracle out of you. We're going to move into some more worship. And we're going to do a couple of songs. But what I want to do, we're going to have a break sort of after like 3 songs.